Perronel desperately tried to think of a spell she could use on the guards, but contact with the ghost of Mr. Miller had left her exhausted, and she had a headache pulsing at the back of her eyes that made it hard to concentrate. A shape suddenly flickered into existence directly ahead of her. Her breath, a foggy white in the chilly air, had briefly formed a face. Perronel glanced at her guards on either side, but they hadn't reacted. She drew in a deep lungful of breath, held it, allowing her body to warm it, and then breathed out in a long, slow exhalation. A face formed in the white mist, that of Jefferson Miller. Perronel frowned. His ghost should be long gone by now. Unless he had come back to tell her something. Nicholas! Instantly, she knew her husband was in danger. Perronel breathed in another great lungful of air and held it. She concentrated hard on Nicholas, seeing him clearly in her mind's eye, with his narrow, rather mournful-looking face, pale eyes, and closely cropped hair. She smiled, remembering him when he'd been younger, and his hair, thick and dark, had been longer than hers. He'd always worn it tied back at the nape of his neck with a purple velvet ribbon. She breathed out, and the air turned into a white cloud that instantly formed into Jefferson Miller's face again. Perronel stared into the ghost's eyes, and there, reflected in his pupils, she could see her husband trapped beneath the paw of the cat-headed goddess. Rage and terror blossomed within her, and suddenly her headache and exhaustion left her. Her silver-threaded black hair rose from her head, as if blown in a strong breeze, sparks of blue and white static snapping along its length. Her ice-white aura flared around her body like a second skin. Too late, the guards realized that something was wrong. They reached for her, but the moment their hands touched the glowing edges of her aura, they were catapulted away as if they'd received an electric shock. One guard even threw himself onto her body, but before he could lay a finger on her, Perronel's aura caught him and propelled him high into the wall with enough force to knock the motorcycle helmet off his head. The figure slid down the wall, arms and legs twisted in awkward positions. When Perronel looked at his face, she realized that the creatures were indeed simulacra. This one was unfinished. His face and head were simply smooth flesh, bald, without eyes, nose, mouth, or ears. The woman raced down the corridor, only pausing when she came to an oily-looking puddle on the floor. Crouching over the puddle, she concentrated hard and touched the murky water with her index and little fingers. Her white aura sizzled when it touched the liquid, and the water briefly smoked before it cleared, and Perronel found she was looking at the scene she had briefly glimpsed in the ghost's eyes. Her husband was lying under Bastet's claws. Behind them, Scatty was struggling to hold off the attacking cats and birds, while Josh stood with his back to a tree, awkwardly clutching a branch like a baseball bat, striking out at anything that came too close. Sophie lay at his feet, moving slowly, blinking in confusion. Perronel glanced up and down the corridor. She could hear noises in the distance, footsteps against stone, and she knew more guards were approaching. She could run and hide, or she could fight the guards. She had a little of her strength back, but that wasn't going to help Nicholas and the children. Perronel looked back into the puddle. In the distance, she could see Hecate withstanding the combined attack of the Morrigan and her birds and Bastet's cats. Perronel also spotted Dee moving around behind Hecate, the sword in his hand glowing bright, poisonous blue, while behind them the Yggdrasil burned with fierce red and green flames. There was one other thing she could do, something desperate and dangerous, and if it succeeded, it would leave her utterly exhausted and completely defenseless. Dee's creatures would simply be able to pick her up and carry her away. Perronel didn't think twice. Crouching over the puddle of dirty water, she placed her right hand, palm up, in her left hand and concentrated fiercely. Perronel's aura began to shift and move, flowing down her arms like drifting smoke, gathering in the palm of her hand, running like liquid along the creases and lines in her flesh. A tiny speck of silver-white light appeared in the folds of skin. It solidified into a perfect sphere, and then it started to spin and grow, and now the ice-white threads of her aura flowed more swiftly down her arms. Within a heartbeat, the sphere was the size of an egg, and then Perronel suddenly reversed her palm and thrust the ball of pure auric energy into the water. She uttered three words. "Sophie, wake up." Chapter 28. "Sophie, wake up." Sophie Newman's eyes snapped open. And then she squeezed them shut again and pressed her hands against her ears. The lights were so bright, so vivid, the sounds of battle so incredibly clear and distinct. "Sophie, wake up." The shock of hearing the voice again forced her to open her eyes and look around. She could hear Perrineau Flamel as clearly as if she were standing beside her, but there was no one there. She was lying propped against the rough bark of an oak tree, with Josh standing beside her, a thick branch clutched in both hands, desperately beating back terrifying creatures. Sophie slowly pushed herself to her feet, holding on to the tree for support. The last thing she clearly remembered was the bitter odor of rich green wood burning. She remembered saying, "Fire!" And then the rest was a series of confused images, a narrow tunnel, creatures with bird heads and cat skulls that might have been dreams. As Sophie's eyes adjusted and she looked around, she realized that they had not been dreams. They were completely surrounded by birds and cats, hundreds of them. Some of the cat-headed humans lurked in the long grass and attempted to creep toward them on all fours or on their bellies, spitting and clawing. There were birdmen in the branches of the tree overhead, maneuvering to get close enough to drop down, while others kept hopping in, jabbing at Josh with their evil-looking beaks. On the opposite side of the field, the Yggdrasil burned. The ancient wood snapped and cracked, plumes of white-hot sap boiling up into the pristine air like fireworks. But even as the burnt wood fell away, new growth appeared, fresh and green in its place. Sophie was conscious of another sound too, and realized she was listening to the Yggdrasil. And now, with her incredibly sensitive hearing, she thought she could make out phrases and words, snatches of songs and fragments of poems within the agonized cries of the burning tree. In the distance, she could see Hecate desperately trying to put out the fires, but she was also fighting the Morrigan, the cats, and the birds at the same time. Sophie also noticed that there were no more Nahair in the skies, and very few of the Torque Alta remained to guard their ancient mistress. Closer, Sophie spotted Scatty's bright red hair. She, too, was surrounded by dozens of birds and cats. The warrior was moving in what looked like an intricate dance, twin swords flashing, sending the creatures howling back from her. Scatty was trying to fight her way over to where Nicholas Flamel was lying face down on the ground beneath the claws of the most terrifying creature Sophie had ever seen. Bastet, the cat goddess. With her incredibly sharp eyesight, the girl could make out the individual whiskers on Bastet's feline face, and she actually saw a droplet of saliva gather on the overlarge fangs and drip onto the man below. Flamel saw Sophie looking in his direction. He tried to draw a breath, but it was difficult with the heavy creature standing on top of him. "Run," he whispered. "Run." "Sophie, I only have a few moments." Perrineau's voice echoed inside the girl's head, shocking her to full alertness. "This is what you must do. You must let me speak through you." Josh became aware that his sister was climbing to her feet, swaying slightly, hands pressed to her ears as if the sounds were too much, eyes squeezed tightly shut. He saw her lips move, as if she were talking to herself. He lashed out at a pair of humans with mockingbird heads as they darted forward. The heavy branch caught one of the creatures squarely on the beak, and it staggered back, dazed and stunned. The other continued to circle Josh, who realized that it was not coming for him. It was trying to get to Sophie. He turned and lashed out at it, but at that moment, a tall, slender man with a tabby cat's head came bounding toward him. Josh tried to swing the branch, but he was off balance, and the catman ducked under the blow. Then it leapt into the air, mouth gaping, claws extended. With a sour taste at the back of his throat, Josh admitted to himself that he and Sophie were in desperate trouble. He needed to get to his sister. He had to protect her. And in that instant, he knew he was not going to make it. He closed his eyes at the last minute as the savage cat-headed creature slammed into his chest, expecting to feel the sting of its claws, to hear its squalling roar in his face. But all he heard was a gentle purring. He blinked his eyes open and found he was holding a fluffy kitten in his arms. Sophie! He turned around and stopped in awe. Sophie's aura had flared pure silver around her body. It was so dense in places that it even reflected the sunlight, making it appear like a medieval suit of armor. Silver sparks crackled through her hair and dripped from her fingers like liquid. Sophie? Josh whispered, elated. His sister was fine. And then Sophie slowly turned her head to look at Josh, and he experienced the shocking, sickening realization that she did not recognize him. The birdman that had been moving in to attack the girl suddenly darted forward, beak stabbing at her eyes. Sophie snapped her fingers. Tiny droplets of silver spun away from her hands to splash against the creature. Instantly, it folded and twisted in on itself and became a disorientated hermit thrush. Sophie walked past her brother and stepped toward Bastet.
No farther, little girl,
Bastet commanded, raising a clawed hand. Sophie's eyes opened wide and she smiled. And Josh suddenly found that, for the first time in his life, he was frightened of his own sister. He knew that this wasn't his Sophie. This terrifying creature could not be his twin. When the girl spoke, her voice was a harsh croak.
You have no idea what I can do to you.
Bastet's huge feline eyes blinked in surprise.
You can do nothing to me, little girl.
I am no girl. You may be ancient, but you have never encountered anything like me. I possess the raw power that can nullify your magic. I can use it to return the birds and cats to their natural forms.
Sophie's head tilted to one side, a gesture Josh knew well. His sister did it when she was listening intently to someone. Then she stretched out her hands toward the dark elder.
What do you think would happen if I were to reach out and touch you?
Bastet hissed a command, and a trio of huge catmen raced toward the girl. Sophie flung out her arm, and a long, whip-like snaking coil of silver energy flowed from her hand. It touched each of the cats, crackling across their haunches and shoulders, and they immediately came to stumbling halts, rolling and twisting on the ground as they transformed into ordinary, everyday cats, two short hairs and a ragged-looking Persian. The cats bounded to their feet and streaked off, howling piteously. Sophie spun the whip above her head, scattering drops of liquid silver in every direction.
Let me give you a taste of what I can do.
The silver whip cracked and snapped as she approached. Scatty suddenly found that three of her adversaries had transformed into an American robin, a house finch, and a song sparrow, while the exotic-looking catman directly in front of her warped into a confused Siamese. Sophie cracked the silver whip again and again, beating away their attackers, droplets of silver splashing everywhere, and more of the cat and birdmen returned to their natural forms.
Get away from Nicholas,
she said, her lips not moving in sync with her words,
or we will find out what your true shape is, Bastet, who is also Maftet, Sekhmet, and Menhit.
Bastet slowly stepped away from Flamel and raised herself to her full, towering height. Her slit-pupiled eyes were wide, her mouth tightly closed.
It has been a long time since anyone has called me by those names. Who are you? Certainly no modern Humani girl.
Sophie's mouth moved, the words taking a moment or two to follow.
Beware this girl, Bastet. She is your doom.
Bastet's fur was bristling, and her bare arms dimpled with goosebumps. Then she slowly backed away, turned, and raced toward the burning Yggdrasil. For the first time in millennia, she was frightened. Nicholas dragged himself to his feet and staggered toward Sophie, Josh, and Scatty. He stepped up to Sophie.
Perenel?
He whispered. Sophie turned her head to him, eyes blank and unseeing. Her mouth worked, and then, as in a badly dubbed movie, the words came.
I'm in San Francisco, held in the basement of Enoch Enterprises. I'm safe and well. Take the children south, Nicholas.
There was a long moment of silence. Then, when she spoke again, the words came quicker than Sophie's lips could move, and the girl's silver aura began to fade, and her eyes started to close.
Take them to the witch.
Chapter 29. Dr. John Dee was becoming frantic. Everything was falling apart, and now there was every possibility that he was going to have to take an active part in the battle. Flamel, Scatty, and the twins had managed to escape from the interior of the Yggdrasil, and were now fighting on the opposite side of the field, no more than 200 yards away, but he couldn't get to them. It would mean crossing a battlefield. The last of the Torque Alta, both in their human and boar form, fought running battles with the cat and bird men. The Naher had already been defeated. Initially, the winged serpents had brought chaos and confusion to the cats and birds, but they were lumbering and awkward on the ground, and most had been killed once they'd landed. The massive army of Torque Alta had thinned considerably, and he guessed that within the hour there would be no more werebores left in North America. But he could not afford to wait that long. He had to get to Flamel now. He had to retrieve the pages of the Codex as soon as possible. From his hiding place behind a clump of bushes, Dee watched the elders. Hecate was standing in the doorway to her tree home, surrounded by the last of her personal Torque Alta guard. While the boars fought the cats and birds, Hecate alone faced down the combined forces of the Morrigan and Bastet. The three ignored the half-human animals fighting around them. To the casual observer, it would have seemed as if the three elders were simply staring at one another. Dee, however, noted the purple-gray clouds that gathered only above the Yggdrasil. He saw how the delicate white and gold flowers strewn around the huge tree withered and died, turning to black paste in an instant. He had seen the unsightly sheen of fungus that appeared on the smoothly polished stone path. Dee smiled. Surely it would not be long now. How much longer could Hecate stand against the two elders, aunt and niece? But the goddess showed no sign of weakening. And then she struck back. Although the air, now stinking from the burning tree, was still, Dee watched as an invisible, unfelt breeze whipped the Morrigan's cloak about her shoulders and buffeted the huge Bastet, making her tilt her head and lean forward into the wind. The patterns on Hecate's metallic dress whirled with blinding rapidity, the colors blurred and distorted. With growing alarm, he saw a dark shadow floating across the withering grass, and then watched as a swarm of tiny black flies settled on Bastet's fur, crawling into her ears and up her nose. The cat goddess howled and staggered back, rubbing furiously at her face. She fell to the ground, rolling over and over in the long grass, attempting to free herself from the insects. More and more kept coming, and they were joined by fire ants and recluse spiders, which crawled out of the grass and swarmed over her body. Crouched on all fours, she threw back her head and screamed in agony, then turned and ran across the field, rolling and crawling in the grass, splashing through a little pool, trying to clean the insects from her body. She was more than halfway across the field before the thick, swirling cloud left her. She rubbed furiously at her face and arms, leaving long scratches on her skin, before climbing to her feet and striding back toward the Yggdrasil. And then the swarm of flies, thicker now, reformed in the air before her. In that moment, Dee considered that perhaps, just perhaps, Hecate could win. Splitting Bastet and the Morrigan had been a masterstroke. Ensuring that Bastet could not get back was simply genius. Realizing that she could not return to the Yggdrasil, Bastet hissed her rage, then turned and raced over to where Flamel, Skatty, and the twins were trying to defend themselves. Dee saw her leap an incredible distance and bring the alchemist to the ground. That gave him some satisfaction at least, and he allowed himself a slight smile, which quickly faded. He was still trapped on this side of the field. How was he going to get past Hecate? Even though the Yggdrasil was burning furiously, with whole sections blazing, burning leaves and blackened strips of branches spiraling down, sticky streamers of sap exploding from collapsing branches, Hecate's powers seemed undiminished. Dee ground his teeth in frustration. All his research indicated that Hecate had brought the tree to life by imbuing it with a little of her own life force. In turn, as it grew, it renewed and replenished her powers. Burning the tree had been his idea. He had imagined that as it burned, she would weaken. But on the contrary, setting the tree alight had only served to enrage the goddess, and her anger had made her all the more deadly. When Dee saw Hecate's lips twitch in what might have been a smile, and the Morrigan stagger and then step back, he began to realize that here, in her own shadow realm, the goddess with three faces was simply too strong for them. Dee knew then that he would have to act. Keeping to the shadows of the trees and tall grasses, he moved around the trunk of the enormous Yggdrasil. He was forced to crouch down and hide as a Torque Alta in its boar shape crashed through the undergrowth directly in front of him, with at least a dozen cat people and twice that number of birdmen clinging to him. Dee came out of the undergrowth on the opposite side of the tree from where Hecate and the Morrigan fought. To his right, he could see that something was happening with Flamel's group. Birds and cats were scattering in every direction. And then he realized that he was seeing ordinary birds and everyday cats fleeing, not the half-human creatures. The Morrigan's and Bastet's transformation spells were failing. Was Hecate that powerful? He had to end this now. Dr. John Dee lifted the short-bladed sword in his hand. Dirty blue light coiled down its length, and for an instant the ancient stone blade hummed as an invisible breeze moved across the edge. The twisting snakes carved into its hilt came to twisting, hissing life. Gripping the hilt tightly, Dee pressed the point of the blade against the gnarled bark of the ancient tree and pushed. Excalibur slid smoothly into the wood, sinking right up to the hilt without resistance. For a long moment, nothing happened, and then Yggdrasil began to moan. The sound was like that of an animal in pain. Beginning as a deep grumbling, it quickly rose to a high-pitched whimpering. Where the hilt of the sword protruded from the tree, a blue stain appeared. Like dripping ink, it flowed down the tree and seeped into the ground. Then the oily blue light ran along the veins and seams of wood. Yggdrasil's cries grew higher and higher until they were almost beyond human hearing. The surviving Torque Alta fell to the ground, writhing in pain, clutching at their ears. Birdmen whirled in confusion, and the cat people began to hiss and howl in unison. The blue stain raced around the tree, coating everything in a thin veneer of glittering ice crystals that reflected the light. Blue, black, and purple-green rainbows shimmered in the air. The oily stain shot up the length of the tree and out along the branches, turning everything it touched to faceted crystals. Even the fire was not immune to it. Flames froze, fire caught in ornate and intricate patterns, then spiderwebbed like ice on the surface of a pond and dissolved to sparkling dust. Where the blue stain touched the leaves, they hardened and broke away from the branches. They did not spiral to the ground. They fell and shattered with tiny tinkling sounds, while the branches, now solid pieces of ice, ripped away from the trunk of the tree and crashed to the earth. Dee threw himself to one side to avoid being impaled by a 3-foot length of frozen branch. Catching hold of Excalibur's hilt, he dragged the stone blade free of the ancient tree and ran for cover. The Yggdrasil was dying. Huge slabs of bark sheared off, like icebergs breaking away from an ice cap, and crashed to the ground, littering the beautiful Shadow Realm landscape with shards of razor-sharp ice. Keeping his distance and watching for falling branches, Dee raced around the tree. He needed to see Hecate. The goddess with three faces was dying. Standing quite still before the crumbling Yggdrasil, Hecate was flickering through her three faces, young, mature, and old, in heartbeats. The change was happening so fast that her flesh had no time to adapt, and she was caught between phases. Young eyes in an old face, a girl's head on a woman's body with a child's arms. Her ever-changing dress had lost all color and was the same solid black as her skin. Dee stood beside the Morrigan, and they watched in silence. Bastet rejoined them, and together the three observed Hecate and Yggdrasil's last moments. The world tree was now almost entirely blue, covered with a sheath of ice. Frozen roots had burst through the ground, destroying the perfect symmetry of the earth, cutting thick gouges in the soil. Huge holes had appeared in the massive trunk, revealing the circular rooms within, which were warped and stained with the blue ice. Hecate's transformations slowed. The changes were taking longer to materialize, because now the blue stain was slowly creeping up her body, hardening her skin, turning it to ice crystals. The Morrigan glanced at the blade in Dee's hand, then quickly looked away.
"Even after all these years in our employ, Dr. Dee, you can still surprise us," she said quietly. "I was not aware that you possessed the Sword of Ice."
"I'm glad I brought it," Dee said, not directly answering her. "It seems Hecate's powers were stronger than we suspected. At least my guess that her strength was connected to the tree was correct." What remained of the Yggdrasil was now a solid block of ice. Hecate, too, was completely covered beneath a frozen sheet, though behind the blue crystals, her butter-colored eyes were bright and alive. The top of the tree began to melt, dirty water running down the length of the bark, cutting deep grooves into it. "When I realized that she had the power to nullify your spells, I knew I had to do something," Dee said. "I saw how the cats and birds were reverting to their natural shapes."
"That was not Hecate's doing,"
Bastet growled suddenly, her accent thick, her voice beast-like. The Morrigan and Dee turned to look at the cat goddess. The creature raised a furry claw and pointed across the field.
"It was the girl. Someone spoke through her, someone who knew my true names. Someone who used the girl's aura to wield a whip of pure energy. That's what reversed our spells."
Dee looked across the field, where he had seen Flamel, Scatty, and the twins gathered around the oak tree. But there was no sign of them. He was turning to order the surviving cats and birds to find them, when he spotted Senuhet staggering up. The old man was spattered with mud and blood, though none of the blood seemed to be his, and he had lost one of his curved bronze swords. The second had snapped in half.
"Flamel and the others have escaped," he gasped. "I followed them out of the Shadow Realm. They're stealing our car," he added indignantly.
Howling his rage, Dr. John Dee spun around and flung Excalibur at the Yggdrasil. The stone blade struck the ancient world tree, which tolled with the solemn sound of a great bell. The single note, high-pitched and serene, hung, vibrating on the air. And then the Yggdrasil began to crack. Long fractures and tears ran the height of the tree. They started small, but widened as they raced upward in ragged patterns. Within moments, the entire tree was covered in the crazed zigzagging. Then the Yggdrasil shattered, and came crashing down on the ice statue of Hecate, crushing it to dust. Chapter 30. Josh Newman jerked open the door of the black SUV and felt a wave of relief wash over him. The keys were in the ignition. He pulled open the rear door and held it while Nicholas Flamel hurried toward the car, carrying Sophie in his arms. He reached in and gently stretched her out on the back seat. Scatty burst through the barrier of leaves and came hurtling down the path, a broad smile on her face.
"Now that," she said as she launched herself into the back of the SUV, "was the most fun I've had in the millennium."
Josh climbed into the driver's seat, adjusted it, and turned the key in the ignition. The big V6 engine growled to life. Flamel hopped into the passenger seat and slammed the door.
"Get us out of here."
Josh pushed the gear shift into drive, gripped the leather steering wheel in both hands, and pressed the accelerator flat to the floor. The big Hummer lurched forward, kicking up stones and dirt as he spun it in a circle and then set off down the narrow path, rocking and bouncing over the ruts, tree branches and bushes scraping its sides, scoring lines along its pristine paintwork. Although the sun had risen in both the shadow realm and the real world, the road was still in deep shadow, and no matter where Josh looked, he still couldn't find the controls for the lights. He kept glancing in the side and rearview mirrors, expecting at any moment to see the Morrigan or the cat goddess step through the wall of vegetation behind them. It was only when the path ended in a burst of sunshine, and he wrenched the steering wheel to the right, turning the heavy SUV onto the narrow, winding blacktop, that he eased off the gas. The Hummer immediately lost speed.
"Everyone okay?" he asked shakily.
He tilted the rearview mirror down so that he could see into the back. His twin lay stretched across the wide leather seats, her head on Scatty's lap. The warrior was using a scrap of cloth torn from her t-shirt to wipe the girl's forehead. Sophie's skin was deathly white, and although her eyes were closed, her eyeballs moved erratically beneath her lids, and she twitched as if she was having a nightmare. Scatty caught Josh looking at them in the glass, and she smiled in encouragement.
"She's going to be okay," she said.
"Is there anything you can do?"
Josh demanded, glancing at Flamel sitting next to him. His feelings for the alchemist were completely confused now. On the one hand, he had placed them in terrible danger, and yet Josh had seen how savagely Flamel had fought in their defense.
"There's nothing I can do," Flamel said tiredly. "She is simply exhausted, nothing more."
Nicholas also looked worn out. His clothes were streaked with mud and what might have been blood. Bird feathers stuck in his hair, and both hands were scratched from his encounters with the cats.
"Let her sleep, and when she wakens in a few hours' time, she will be fine. I promise you."
Josh nodded. He concentrated on the road ahead of him, unwilling to continue the conversation with the alchemist. He doubted that his sister would ever be fine again. He'd seen how she looked at him, her eyes blank and staring. She hadn't recognized him. He'd listened to the voice that had come out of her mouth. It wasn't the voice he'd known. His sister, his twin, had been utterly changed. They came up on a sign from Mill Valley, and he turned left. He had no idea where they were going. He just wanted to get away from the shadow realm. More than that, he wanted to go home, wanted to go back to a normal life. He wanted to forget that he'd ever come across that ad in the university newspaper his father had brought home. "Assistant wanted, bookshop. We don't want readers, we want workers." He'd sent in a resume, and a few days later, he'd been called for an interview. Sophie had had nothing else to do that day and had come along for company. While she'd been waiting, she'd gone to the shop across the road for a chai latte. When Josh had come out of the small bookshop, beaming delightedly because he'd been offered the job, he'd discovered that Sophie had found a job as well, in the coffee cup. They would be working right across the road from each other. It was perfect. And it had been perfect, until yesterday, when this madness had begun. He had trouble believing it had only been yesterday. He looked in the mirror at Sophie again. She was resting quietly now, completely still, but he was relieved to see that a little color had come back into her cheeks. What had Hecate done? No, what had Flamel done? It all came back to the alchemist. This was his fault. The goddess hadn't wanted to awaken the twins. She knew the dangers. But Flamel had pushed, and now, because of the alchemist, Hecate's shadow realm paradise was under attack, and his sister had become a stranger to him. When Josh had started working in the bookshop for the man he knew then as Nick Fleming, he'd thought he was a little strange, eccentric, maybe even a little weird. But as he'd gotten to know him, he'd come to genuinely like the man and to admire him. Fleming was everything Josh's father wasn't. He was funny and interested in just about everything Josh did, and his knowledge of trivia was incredible. Josh knew that his father, Richard, was really only happy and comfortable when he was standing before a lecture hall full of students or buried up to his knees in dirt. Fleming was different. When Josh quoted Bart Simpson to him, Fleming countered with Groucho Marx, and then went further and introduced Josh to the movies of the Marx brothers. They shared a love of music, even though their tastes were widely different. Josh introduced Nick to Green Day, Lamb, and Dido. Fleming recommended Peter Gabriel, Genesis, and Pink Floyd. When Josh let Fleming listen to some ambient and trance on his iPod, Fleming loaned him CDs of Mike Oldfield and Brian Eno. Josh introduced Nick to the world of blogging and showed him his and Sophie's blog, and they had even started talking about putting the entire shop's stock online. In time, Josh had come to think of Fleming as the older brother he'd always wished he had. And now that man had betrayed him. In fact, he'd been lying to Josh from the very beginning. He hadn't even been Nick Fleming. And somewhere, at the back of Josh's mind, an ugly question was beginning to form. Keeping his voice low and his eyes on the road ahead, he asked, "Did you know all this would happen?" Flamel sat back into the deep leather seat and turned to look at Josh. The alchemist was partially in shadow, and he clutched the seatbelt across his chest with both hands. "What would happen?" he asked carefully. "You know, I'm not a kid," Josh said, his voice rising, "so don't talk to me like one." In the rear seat, Sophie muttered a little in her sleep, and he forced himself to lower his voice. "Did your precious book predict all this?" He caught a glimpse of Scatty moving in the back seat and realized she had eased forward to hear the alchemist's answer. Flamel took a long time before replying. Finally, he said, "There are some things you must know first about the Book of Abraham the Mage." He saw Josh open his mouth, and he pressed on quickly. "Let me finish. I always knew the Codex was old," he began, "though I never knew just how old. Yesterday Hecate said she was there when Abraham created it, and that would have been at least 10,000 years ago. The world was a very different place then. The commonly held view is that mankind appeared in the middle of the Stone Age, but the truth is very, very different. The Elder Race ruled the Earth. We have scraps of the truth in our mythology and legends. If you believe the stories," he continued, "they possessed the power of flight. They had vessels that could cross the oceans, they could control the weather, and had even perfected what we would call cloning. In other words, they had access to a science that was so advanced, we would call it magic." Josh started to shake his head. This was too much to take in. "And before you say this is all far-fetched, just think how far the human race has come in the past 10 years. If someone had told your parents, for example, that they would be able to carry their entire music library in their pocket, would they have believed it? Now we have phones that have more computing power than was used to send the first rockets into space. We have electron microscopes that can see individual atoms. We routinely cure diseases that only 50 years ago were fatal. And the rate of change is increasing. Today, we are able to do what your parents would have dismissed as impossible, and your grandparents as nothing short of magical." "You haven't answered my question," Josh said. He was watching his speed carefully. They couldn't afford to be pulled over. What I'm saying to you is that I do not know what the Elder Race was able to do. Was Abraham making predictions in the Codex, or was he simply writing down what he had somehow seen? Was he aware of the future? Could he actually see it? He swiveled around in the seat to look at Scatty. Do you know? She shrugged, lips curling into a little smile. I'm next generation. Much of the Elder world had vanished before I was even born, and Danu Talis was long sunk beneath the waves. I've no idea what they could do. Could they see through time? She paused, thinking. I've known elders who seem to have that gift. Sybil certainly could, and so could Themis, and Melampus, of course. But they were wrong more often than they were right. If my travels have taught me anything, it is that we create our own future. I've watched world-shaking events come and go without anyone making predictions about them, and I've also seen prophecies, usually to do with the end of the world, that also failed to happen. A car overtook them on the narrow country road, the first they had seen so far that morning. I'm going to ask you the question one more time, Josh said, struggling to keep his voice even. And this time, just give me a straight yes or no answer. Was everything that just happened predicted in the Codex? No, Flamel said quickly. I hear a but in there somewhere, Scatty said. The alchemist nodded. There is a little but. There is nothing in the book about Hecate or the Shadow Realm, nothing about Dee or Bastet or the Morrigan, but, he sighed, there are several prophecies about twins. Twins, Josh said tightly. You mean twins in general, or specifically to do with Sophie and me? The Codex speaks of silver and gold twins, the two that are one, the one that is all. It is no coincidence that your auras are pure gold and silver. So yes, I am convinced the Codex is referring to you and your sister. He leaned forward to look at Josh. And if you are asking me how long I've known that, then the answer is this. I began to suspect only yesterday when you and Sophie came to my aid in the shop. Hecate confirmed my suspicions a few hours later when she made your auras visible. I give you my word that everything I've done has been for your protection. Josh started to shake his head. He wasn't sure he believed Flamel. He opened his mouth to ask a question, but Scatty put her hand on his shoulder before he could speak. Let me just say this, she said, her voice low and serious, her Celtic accent suddenly pronounced. I've known Nicholas Flamel for a very long time. America was barely even colonized when we first met. He is many things, dangerous and devious, cunning and deadly, a good friend and an implacable enemy. But he comes from an age when a man's word was indeed precious. If he gives you his word that he's done all this for your protection, then I am suggesting that you believe him. Josh eased on the brake, and the car slowed as it rounded a corner. Finally, he nodded and let out his breath in a deep sigh. I believe you, he said aloud. But somewhere in the back of his mind, he kept hearing Hecate's last words to him. Nicholas Flamel never tells anyone everything. And he had the distinct impression that the alchemist still wasn't telling everything he knew. Suddenly, Nicholas tapped Josh's arm. Here. Stop here. Why? What's wrong? Scatty demanded, reaching for her swords. Josh signaled and pulled the Hummer off the road to where a roadside diner sign had flickered into life. Nothing's wrong, Flamel grinned. Just time for some breakfast. Great, I'm famished, Scatty said. I could eat a horse, if I weren't a vegetarian. And liked horse, of course. And you weren't a vampire, Josh thought, but kept his mouth shut. Sophie woke up while Scatty and Flamel were in the diner ordering breakfast to go. One moment she was asleep, the next she sat bolt upright in the back seat. Josh jumped and was unable to prevent a little startled cry from escaping his lips. He swiveled around in the driver's seat, kneeling up to lean over the back. Sophie? He asked cautiously. He was terrified that something strange and ancient would look through his sister's eyes again.
"You don't want to know what I was dreaming about,"
Sophie said, stretching her arms wide and arching her back. Her neck cracked as she rotated it.
"Ow! I ache everywhere."
"How do you feel?"
"Well, it sounded like his sister."
"Like I'm coming down with the flu." She looked around.
"Where are we? Whose car is this?"
Josh grinned, teeth white in the shadows.
"We stole it from Dee.
We're somewhere on the road out of Mill Valley, heading back into San Francisco, I think."
"What happened? What happened back there?" Sophie asked.
Josh's smile broadened into a wide grin.
"You saved us.
With your newly awakened powers, you were incredible. You had a silver whip energy thing, and every time it touched one of the cats or birds, it changed them back into their real forms."
He trailed off as she started to shake her head.
"You don't remember anything?"
"A little. I could hear Perrinil talking to me, telling me what to do. I could actually feel her pouring her aura into me," she said in awe. "I could hear her. I could even see her, sort of."
She suddenly drew in a deep, shuddering breath.
"Then they came for her. That's all I can remember."
"Who did?"
"The faceless men. Lots of faceless men. I watched them drag her away."
"What do you mean, faceless men?" Sophie's eyes were wide and terrified.
"They had no faces."
"Like masks?"
"No, Josh. Not masks. Their faces were smooth. No eyes, no nose, no mouth. Just smooth skin."
The image that formed in his head was deeply disturbing, and he deliberately changed the subject.
"Do you feel different?" He chose the word carefully.
Sophie took a moment to consider.
What was wrong with Josh? Why was he so concerned?
Different? How?
"Do you remember Hecate awakening your powers?"
"I do."
"What did it feel like?"
he asked hesitantly. For a moment, Sophie's eyes flickered with cold silver light.
"It was as if someone had flipped a switch in my head, Josh. I felt alive. For the first time in my life, I felt alive."
Josh felt a sudden inexplicable pang of jealousy. From the corner of his eye, he spotted Flamel and Scatty leaving the diner, arms piled high with bags.
"And how do you feel now?"
"Hungry," she said.
"Extremely hungry."
They ate in silence. Breakfast burritos, eggs, sausage, grits and rolls washed down with soda. Scatty had fruit and water. Josh finally wiped his mouth with a napkin and brushed breadcrumbs off his jeans. It was the first proper meal he'd had since lunchtime the day before.
"I feel human again."
He glanced sideways at Scatty.
"No offense."
"None taken," Scatty assured him. "Believe me, I've never wanted to be human, though there are, I believe, some advantages," she added enigmatically.
Nicholas bundled up the remains of their breakfast and shoved them into the paper bag. Then he leaned forward and tapped the screen of the satellite navigation system set into the dashboard.
"Do you know how this works?"
Josh shook his head.
"In theory, I guess. We put in a destination and it tells us the best way to get there. I've never used one before, though. My dad's car hasn't got one," he added.
Richard Newman drove a 5-year-old Volvo station wagon.
"If you looked at it, could you make it work?"
Flamel persisted.
"Maybe,"
Josh said doubtfully.
"Of course he can. Josh is a genius with computers," Sophie said proudly from the back seat.
"This is hardly a computer," her twin muttered, leaning forward and hitting the on button. The large square screen flickered to life, and an incredibly patronizing voice warned them about typing addresses into the system while driving, then instructed Josh to hit the OK button, acknowledging that he'd heard and understood the warning. The screen blinked and immediately showed the position of the Hummer on an unnamed back road. Mount Tamalpais appeared as a little triangle at the top of the screen, and arrows pointed south to San Francisco. The little track that led to Hecate's shadow realm wasn't shown.
We need to go south, Flamel continued.
Josh experimented with the buttons until he got the main menu.
Okay, I need an address.
Put in the post office at the corner of Signal Street and Ojai Avenue in Ojai. In the back seat, Scatty stirred.
Oh, not Ojai. Please tell me we're not gone there.
Flamel twisted in his seat.
Perronel told me to go south.
L.A. is south. Mexico is south. Even Chile is south of here. There are lots of nice places that lie to the south.
Perronel told me to take the children to the witch, Flamel said patiently. And the witch is in Ojai.
Sophie and Josh looked quickly at each other, but said nothing.
Scatty sat back and sighed dramatically.
Would it make a difference if I told you I didn't want to go?
None at all.
Sophie crouched between the seats to stare at the little screen.
How long will it take? How far away are we?
She wondered out loud.
It's going to take most of the day, Josh said, leaning forward to squint at the screen.
Where his hair brushed his sister's, a tiny spark crackled between them.
We need to get to Highway 1. We go across the Richmond Bridge, his fingers traced the colored lines, then to I-580, which eventually turns into I-5.
He blinked in surprise.
We stay on that for over 270 miles.
He hit another button, which calculated some totals.
The entire trip is just over 400 miles, and it will take at least 6.5 hours.
Before today, the farthest I've ever driven is about 10 miles.
Well, this will be great practice for you then, the alchemist said with a smile.
Sophie looked from Flamel to Scatty.
Who is this witch we're going to see?
Flamel snapped his seatbelt into place.
We're going to see the Witch of Endor.
Josh turned the key in the ignition and started the car. He glanced in the rearview mirror at Scatty.
Someone else you fought with? He asked.
Skatok grimaced.
Worse than that, she muttered. She's my grandmother.
Chapter 31 The Shadow Realm was breaking down. In the west, the clouds had vanished and huge patches of the sky had already disappeared, leaving only the blinking stars and the overlarge moon in the black sky. One by one, the stars were winking out of existence and the moon was beginning to fray at the edges.
We don't have much time, the Morrigan said, watching the sky.
Dee, who was crouching on the ground, gathering as many ice fragments of Hecate as he could find, thought he could hear a note of fear in the Morrigan's voice.
We have time, he said evenly.
We can't afford to be here when the Shadow Realm disappears,
she continued, looking down at him, her face expressionless. But he knew by the way she hugged the cloak of crow feathers about her shoulders that she was nervous.
What would happen?
Dee wondered aloud. He'd never seen the crow goddess like this before, and he took pleasure in her discomfiture. The Morrigan raised her head to look at the encroaching darkness, her black eyes reflecting the tiny spots of stars.
Why, we'd disappear also, sucked away into the nothingness, she added softly,
watching the mountains in the distance turn to something like dust. The dust then spiraled up into the black sky and vanished.
A true death, the Morrigan murmured.
Dee was crouched among the melting remains of the Yggdrasil, while all around him Hecate's elegant and beautiful world was turning to dust and blowing away on invisible winds. The goddess had created her shadow realm out of nothingness, and now, without her presence to hold it together, it was returning to that once more. The mountains had vanished, blown away like grains of sand, whole swathes of the forest were slowly fading and blinking out of existence, like lights being turned off, and the overlarge moon, hanging low in the sky, was losing shape and definition. Already, it was nothing more than a featureless ball. In the east, the rising sun was a golden orb of light, and the sky was still blue. The crow goddess turned to her aunt.
How long before it all disappears? She asked.
Bastet growled and shrugged her broad shoulders.
Who knows? Even I have never witnessed the death of an entire Shadow Realm. Minutes, perhaps.
That's all I need. D laid the sword Excalibur on the ground. The smoothly polished stone blade reflected the blackness creeping in from the west. D found three of the largest chunks of ice that had once been Hecate and placed them on the blade. The Morrigan and Bastet leaned over his shoulders and stared at the sword, their reflections rippling and distorted.
"What is so important that you must do it here?" Bastet asked.
"This was Hecate's home," Dee replied. "And here, right here, at the place of her death, the connection to her will be strongest."
"Connection," Bastet growled, and then nodded.
She suddenly knew what Dee was about to attempt, the darkest and most dangerous of all the dark arts.
"Necromancy," Dee whispered. "I'm going to talk to the dead goddess."
"She spent so many millennia here that it is part of her. I'm wagering her consciousness remains active and attached to this place." He reached out and touched the handle of the sword. The black stone glowed yellow, and the carved snakes around the hilt came briefly alive, hissing furiously, tongues flickering, before they solidified once again. As the ice melted, the liquid ran over the black stone, covering it in a thin, oily sheen.
"Now we shall see what we shall see," he muttered. The water on the blade began to bubble and pop, sizzling and crackling, and a face appeared in each bubble. Hecate's face. It kept flickering through her three guises, only the eyes, butter-colored and hateful, remaining the same as she glared at him.
"Talk to me," Dee shouted. "I command you. Why did Flamel come here?" Hecate's voice was a bubbling, watery snap.
"To escape you. Tell me about the human children."
The images that appeared on the sword blade were surprisingly detailed. They were all from Hecate's perspective. They showed Flamel arriving with the twins, showed the two children sitting, fearful and pale, in the battered and scratched car.
"Flamel believes they are the twins of legend mentioned in the Codex."
The Morrigan and Bastet crowded closer, ignoring the rapidly encroaching nothingness. In the west, there were no longer any stars in the heavens. The moon was gone, and huge portions of the sky had completely vanished, leaving just blackness in its wake.
"Are they?"
Dee demanded. The next image on the sword showed the twins' auras flaring silver and gold.
"Moon and sun," Dee murmured.
He didn't know whether to be horrified or elated. His suspicions were confirmed. From the first moment he'd seen them together, he started to wonder if the teens were, in fact, twins.
"Are these the twins foretold in legend?" he demanded again.
Bastet brought her massive head down next to Dee's. Her foot-long whiskers tickled his face, but he didn't risk brushing them away, not with her teeth so close. She smelled of wet cat and frankincense. Dee felt a sneeze building at the back of his nose. The cat goddess reached out for the blade, but Dee caught her hand in his. It was like grasping a lion's paw, and her retracted claws suddenly appeared dangerously close to his fingers.
"Please don't touch the blade. This is a delicate spell. There is time for perhaps one or two more questions," he added, nodding toward the western horizon, to where the edges of the earth were crumbling, blowing away like multicolored dust.
Bastet glared at the black blade, her slit-pupiled eyes flaring.
"My sister has, or should I say had, a very special gift. She could awaken powers in others. Ask her if she did that with these Humani twins."
Dee nodded in sudden understanding. He had been wondering why Flamel had brought the twins to this place. He remembered now. In the ancient world, it was believed Hecate had power over magic and spells.
"Did you awaken the twins' magical abilities?" he asked.
A single bubble popped.
"No."
Dee rocked back on his heels, surprised. He had been expecting her to say yes. Had Flamel failed then? Bastet growled.
She's lying.
She cannot, Dee said. She answers what we ask.
I saw the girl with my own eyes, the Egyptian goddess growled. I saw her wield a whip of pure auric energy. I've never seen such power in my life, not since the elder times.
Dr. John Dee glanced at her sharply. You saw the girl, but what of the boy? What was he doing?
I did not notice him.
Ha! Dee said triumphantly. He turned back to the sword. The Morrigan's cloak rustled warningly.
Make this your last question, Doctor.
The trio looked up to see that the utter blackness was almost upon them. Less than 10 feet ahead of them, the world ended in nothingness. Dee turned back to the sword.
Did you awaken the girl?
A bubble popped, and the sword ran with images of Sophie rising off the ground, her aura blazing silver.
Yes.
And the boy? The sword showed Josh cowering in a corner of a darkened chamber.
No.
The Morrigan's claw-like hands gripped Dee's shoulders and jerked him to his feet. He caught his sword and shook the bubbling water droplets into the rapidly encroaching void. The mismatched trio, towering Bastet, Dark Morrigan, and small human, raced away as the world crumbled into nothingness behind them. The last remnants of their army, the birdmen and cat people, remained, wandering aimlessly. When they saw their leaders fleeing, they turned to follow. Soon, every creature was racing to the east, where the last of the Shadow Realm remained. Senuhet limped after Bastet, calling out her name, begging her to stop and help him. But the world dissolved too quickly. It swallowed birds and cats. It took the ancient trees and rare orchids, the magical creatures and the mythical monsters. It consumed the last of Hecate's magic. Then the void claimed the sun, and the world went dark and was no more. Chapter 32. The Morrigan and Bastet burst through the tangled hedges, carrying John Dee between them. In the next instant, the wall of foliage vanished, and one of the many winding paths leading to Mount Tamalpais appeared. They stumbled, and Dee fell, sprawling in the dust.
What now? Bastet growled. Have we lost? Have they won? We have destroyed Hecate, but she has awakened the girl.
John Dee staggered to his feet and brushed off his ruined coat. There were scrapes and tears in the sleeve, and something had ripped a fist-size hole through the lining. Carefully wiping Excalibur clean, he slid it back into its concealed sheath. It's not the girl we need to concentrate on now. It's the boy. The boy is the key. The Morrigan shook her head, feathers rustling.
You talk in riddles.
She glanced up into the clear morning skies, and almost directly overhead, a wisp of gray cloud appeared.
He has seen his sister's tremendous magical powers awakened. How do you think the boy is feeling now? Frightened, angry, jealous, alone?
He looked from the Morrigan to the cat goddess.
The boy is at least as powerful as the girl. Is there anyone else on this continent to whom Flamel could take the boy to have his talents awakened?
Black Anis is in the Catskills,
the Morrigan suggested, the note of caution clearly audible in her voice.
Too unpredictable, Dee said. She'd probably eat him.
I heard that Persephone was in northern Canada, Bastet said.
Dee shook his head.
Her years in the underworld Shadow Realm have driven her insane. She's dangerous beyond belief.
The Morrigan drew her cloak tighter around her shoulders. The cloud above her head thickened and drifted lower.
Then there is no one in North America. I came across Noctacula in Austria, and I know that Erichtho still hides out on Thessaly.
You're wrong, Dee interrupted. There is one other who could awaken the boy.
Who?
Bastet growled, frowning, her snout wrinkling. Dr. John Dee turned to the crow goddess.
You could.
The Morrigan stepped away from Dee, black eyes wide with surprise, pointed teeth pressing against the bruise-colored flesh of her thin lips. A ripple ran through her black cloak, ruffling all the feathers.
You are mistaken,
Bastet hissed.
My niece is next generation. She hasn't got the powers.
Dee turned to face the crow goddess. If he knew he was playing a dangerous, possibly even deadly, game, he showed no sign of it. At one time, perhaps that would have been true, but the Morrigan's powers are more, much, much more than they were.
Niece, what is he talking about?
Bastet demanded.
Be very, very careful, Humani,
the crow goddess cackled. My loyalty is not in question here, Dee said quickly. I have served the elders for half a millennium. I am merely looking for a way to achieve our aim. He stepped up to the Morrigan. Once, like Hecate, you wore three faces. You were the Morrigan, the Maha, and the Bab. Unlike Hecate, though, you and your two sisters occupied three bodies. It was your consciousnesses that were linked. Individually, you were powerful, but together, you were invincible. He paused, and seemed to be taking a moment to gather his thoughts, but in actuality, he was ensuring he had a firm grip on Excalibur beneath his coat. When did you decide to kill your sisters? He asked casually. With a terrible screech, the Morrigan leapt for Dee, and stopped. In a flash, Excalibur's black stone blade had appeared at her throat, blue light fizzing and sparking down the blade. The serpent hilt came to life and hissed at her. Please, Dee smiled, a chilling twist of his lips. I've been responsible for the death of one elder today. I've no wish to add a second to my total. As he spoke, he watched Bastet, who was moving around behind him. The Morrigan has the power to awaken the boy, he said quickly. She possesses the knowledge.